It's just the way of things. 1962-66. In 1962, the summer she turned 17, Alice left Florence. She put Kitty Lester's love letters on the jukebox, picked up her guitar and backpack, and said adieu. Ulysses took the train with her to Milan, slipped an envelope of cash and a packed lunch from Julia into her bag. Not so hard to let her go. She went to live at Coles, worked in the pub even though she wasn't really allowed, but everyone knew her, including the coppers who hung out in the snug. She got her portfolio together and saved for art school, the only fixed point on the horizon. Some evenings she sang with Pete, and something new happened then, something she'd never had to confront before. Comparisons with her mother. People said she didn't have Peg's looks, but she did have her voice. It did something to her, it did. Little bit of rage, little bit of ugly. Alice was there when the first stage of demolition began, standing with Carl and Gingin as the wrecking ball swung. The Gothic villas in the square went first. "They called it slum clearance, but we were never a slum, were we?" she wrote to Ulysses and Cress in her first letter home. "Cole said he's not selling the pub, and they'll have to drag him out in a coffin. Ginny cries when the walls fall because she doesn't understand and thinks it's war all over again. Devi came to visit her yesterday and Cole didn't say anything. He's got too much on his plate to fight that battle too. Devi brought a cake and put candles on it to make Cole happy. It wasn't Cole's birthday, but it did make him happy. I miss you both. Love as always." In the January term of 1963, Alice went to Wimbledon School of Art. She lived partly at Coles and partly on a sofa nearby. She lived in a state of uncertainty but came to realize she probably always had. She struggled initially in the way she saw things and how this was expressed as marks on a page, but she turned up every day and she practiced her craft, and that was significant. Until she saw people achieve what she hoped to achieve. And she wanted to be generous and yet at times feared that their success would mean no success for her. She was so impatient for her work to be affirmed. She'd walked into art school hoping to be discovered as the next big thing, only to live in the shadows of disregard. Her mother want became a mother please, and crushes on teachers became evening tutorials of charcoal and perfume. And she read wise words over and over, and yet when she closed the book, it was still her, unchanged, and the disappointment could send her to bed for days. But then, one night in spring, she was invited by friends to a lecture hall in Holborn. Too much dope and the wrong bus had her clattering through the doors and racing up the stairs, suddenly halted by the unmistakable voice of Evelyn Skinner coming from the main hall. She began to laugh.
"Oh, no, no. I totally disagree," said Evelyn. "If women's lives are not documented, then how on earth can we say we have the full picture? We have framed the narrative. Or I should say you and your predecessors have, Mr. Dixon. And wherever there is framing, there is exclusion."
The women in the audience cheered. Alice hurried on up to the balcony, where she saw the magnificent Evelyn Skinner on stage, 82 years old and thriving by the looks of things, looking 10 years younger due to cod liver oil and cold water swimming and frequent dinners at Quo Vadis with Dottie Cunningham. Not that Alice knew that then. All Alice saw was the woman who had left such a lasting impression on her. The balcony was smoky and packed with art students. Alice looked about for her friends and saw Martha in the front row, leaning attentively on the rail. Alice walked down towards her. "Sorry, sorry," she said as she inched along the row. Alice sat down and she and Martha kissed, French style. Alice would put all this down in a letter to Cress and Ulysses. How Evelyn looked, elegant and imposing. Linen slacks and blouse and a bright scarf. Oh, she was marvellous. Evelyn continued. She said,
"Let's take as an example Gentileschi's Susanna and the Elders, on the screen behind me now. Take a good look. It's a biblical story in which a young woman bathing is spied upon by old men who are trying unsuccessfully to blackmail her into sexual relations.
a popular theme in Renaissance and Baroque painting, mainly because of the opportunity it afforded to paint naked female flesh. The audience laughed.
You may well laugh, said Evelyn, and yet these are the choices we are talking about. In Gentileschi's version behind me, we get a woman's point of view, and it is an uncomfortable one. Susanna is centered in the painting, and her anxiety and distress are central to the piece. This is no jocular flirtation. These men are lecherous, scheming, and threatening, whilst she is vulnerable and naked. Her body is twisted. They are abusing her. And the painter knows this because this is her experience.
Outside Conway Hall, the night had turned chill, a slight mist hovering in headlights and street lamps, and even in the flare of a match. Alice was standing on the pavement smoking a cigarette. Her friends were milling about, jumping on scooters, heading into Soho.
Coming. In a bit, said Alice.
An hour passed, and the cold had got in, and Evelyn had been secreted away through another exit. Alice turned around and headed to Soho. Along New Oxford Street, she was gripped by a rare moment of actual mother want, and found a phone box down a side street and filled it with coins.
Ted?
It's Alice.
Peg there?
No, I just want to talk to Peg, please.
Fuck, just get her, will you?
Peg? Yeah, I'm fine. You? Peg, slightly slurring, but sweet. Alice leant against the glass and told Peg about her evening, about the talk, and about Evelyn, and how she'd waited. Peg was good on the subject of waiting. Peg was reassuring. Told her to go and buy some chips and find her friends. Peg was kind before the money ran out. Ulysses folded the letter and said, well, well, well. Evelyn Skinner was back in their life. He said, today's a good day, Cress, and put the letter back in its envelope.
I'll get the coffees in, said Cress.
In May, something significant happened, something unforeseen, something that shook the foundations of that small Florentine world. The iris garden up by the Piazzale Michelangelo had not long opened for the season, and Cress and Paola were first through the gates that day. A rare cream and peach variety had caught Paola's eye, and she'd knelt down to view it better. When Cress turned round, he saw a crowd of people where she had not long been, and they were looking down. It was Cressy who telephoned Michele, who telephoned the best friend in Lazio, who notified the sister and brother, and after that, Paola's death was taken away from him, her body interred with her husband outside Prato, as he knew it would be. But he sat on a stone bench every day, and Julia brought him coffee, and Michele brought him La Nazione to read, and people came to him, spoke words of consolation to him, because they knew. Cressy and Paola, they were something, weren't they? That the people of the square understood was enough for Cress. And he had the iris garden, of course. That it was open for a mere 4 weeks a year made it the most private, the most perfect of resting places. Cress got old quick that summer, but that's grief for you. That's what Ulysses said in a call to Col and Pete and Peg. All three huddled around the telephone in the pub late one night in July. What can we do for the old Romeo? Said Col, and Ulysses said, be gentle. And that shut Col up quick. Col even apologized in case he was out of line. I'll keep you posted, said Ulysses. And we'll think up something too, said Peg. Tell him he's my rock. Tell him, you know. I will. Words as gold dust, Peg. You got it.
She said that,
said Cress. She did. Cress drank his coffee that morning, even had a pastry too. Peg's words, you see. The old fella simply loved her. It would be wrong to say Cress wouldn't be the same again, because he would, but he needed time. So Ulysses took over the running of the pensione, coffee dripping into espresso cups by the 8 a.m. bells, pastries on the plates and a tray outside every door, a little knock, walk away, the door open, the sound of delight. Ulysses did the changeovers too, drove the heavy linens over to Manfredi's. Alice even wrote a telegram to see if Ulysses wanted her home. Stay put, my sweet, and thrive. He'd never written anything so poetic in his life. She'd keep that telegram all her life. Cress stayed on the terrace with his citrus tree, surrounded by scent and blossom. Tree said few words, and together they watched the pungent flare of dawn, the glare of the midday trope, the drift of dusk. Cress slept a lot. Cress kept dreaming of butterflies. The scene. Late August. An eerie, soporific trance of a day. Heat settling across the city like a fucking furnace, Cole's words. Shutters bolted firmly against the scorching haze, and the square lifeless, except for a couple of malnourished pigeons and the odd tourist at Michele's, forking strands of spaghetti into parched mouths, wishing they'd ordered a salad instead. When all of a sudden, an ambulance siren, wailing and screaming, banshee-like. A sound Ulysses hadn't heard in 10 years. What the? He said, waking up from a nap. He got off the sofa and threw open the shutters. Well, I bloody never, he said to Claude. Claude flew to the window and had a run on droppings. Ulysses slung on a shirt and raced down the stairs. The elderly Contessa was waiting for him at the bottom.
You need new friends, she said.
Si, si, I know, Contessa, he said. Out of the door now and into the sunshine, tucking in his shirt and protecting his eyes from the glare. He watched the green ambulance appear at the side of the basilica, Cole shouting and swearing and hammering the dash, and Pete barely holding on to the remaining back door as it jolted across the uneven stones. Shutters on all sides of the square were flung open to witness the commotion. Suddenly, the van came to a halt, and Pete was thrown out headfirst. The wailing stopped, and the thick silence was broken only by the sound of two hubcaps rolling menacingly into the gutter. Pete crawled towards Ulysses and said, Never again. What happened, Pete?
We lost one of the back doors the other side of Parma. Caused a pile-up on a major road. Cole took off, and only Peg's quick thinking stopped me from ending up under an Alfa Romeo.
Peg?
Yeah, said Pete. She held onto my legs till Cole could pull over and help drag me back in.
Peg's here?
Yeah. Hey, Peg.
Quite the introduction she'd hoped for, but there you have it. Peg slunk out, bare legs and heels first, followed by a belted midi short-sleeved dress in emerald green. Sunglasses hid the 10 years older, and the sun highlighted the 10 years blonder. Oh my God, said Ulysses. Clack, 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 across the stone she went, hips swaying, arms swinging, Peg's tune, right? And there it was again, that little churn in Ulysses' guts. Peg, what the worst fucking days of my life, Temps. Don't ask. Don't ever, ever ask. Ulysses opened his arms and held her. I've missed you, he whispered.
Oi! No one ever interested in me, said Cole. What am I? Chop fucking liver?
Pete began to retch.
Keep your mouth shut, Cole, said Peg. Oh, that's nice. Mouth. And Peg pointed to it.
Cole blew into his hands and recoiled.
Anyone got a mint? He said.
Come here, said Ulysses, pulling him into a tight clasp. That's more like it, said Cole. The sound of a door latch made them turn. It was Cressy. A bit sleepy and dazed, he looked from one to the other and said,
Peg? Cole? Pete?
Hasn't lost his memory then, said Cole. Shut up, Cole. Said Peg.
What are you all doing here? Said Cress.
We're here for you, Cress, said Pete. Make sure you're okay.
Course I'm okay.
Cress choked now. Oh, those watery eyes.
Course I am.
Come here, said Peg. Cress did as he was told because Peg's arms were a good place to be. Cress had shrunk. It's okay, said Peg. It's okay. They clattered up the stairs, carried on with the same old yakking and joshing from where they'd left off.
They passed the entrance to the pensione, which had been taken over by an art history group from Leamington Spa. And Cress said they were a fractious lot, due to differing views on Leonardo and Raphael. By the time Cress put his key in the door and led them into the hallway, rooms had been divvied up, and it was decided that Peg would be in Alice's room, Peter in with Ulysses, and no one wanted to room with Cole. "Oh, that's really nice, that is," said Cole. It was strange for Peg to be standing in her daughter's room after so many years. A bed shoved up in the corner, an easel and a drawing desk the only furniture. Disused tomato cans full of pencils, empty wine bottle with a candle in the top, and a paint-splattered terracotta floor that looked more terrazzo in style now. The photo of Eddie was stuck to the wall with tape. Still that yearning between Peg's legs. Oh, where the fuck did the time go? Peg old enough to be his mother now, sort of twists the story of their love to something odd. 20 years of loving and hoping had broken her and allowed Ted to slip in through the cracks, and there was no turning back. I sold my soul, Eddie, and I feel that vacancy every single day. And now our kid, all grown up, at art school. All your talent, you'd be so proud. And she looks like you too, Eddie. Got my smile, they say, but I only see you. And sometimes it hurts to look at her smooth skin and the years she has ahead. And I want to slap her, Eddie. And that's why I have to keep her at arm's length, because sometimes she makes me bitter. And I don't want to be bitter, because it unseats the love. And I just don't know what to do. So that's me, Eddie, who I've become. My mother, after all. She moved away. Stood in front of a portrait of Alice, a proper drawing. White pencil capturing the light in her eyes, so fierce and intense. And Peg suddenly realized how little the kid was when she'd let her go. She felt an ache in her guts, but she hadn't eaten, so maybe that was it. She lowered her face to the few clothes hanging on a rail. She didn't know her daughter's smell, but it was the closest she'd ever felt to her. Peg sat on the bed and looked out through the doorway. Some kind of commotion. Cole was trying to stem the blood from his nose, Pete holding Claude protectively, Cress telling Cole, "Well, what do you expect, making a parrot feel diminished like that?" Old Cressy, how she'd missed him. How he knew her. How he could soothe her. Coming here had been her idea. She let Cole take the credit. But it was her, because she knew what happened when the waves hit. That lurching shift when the ballast slides into empty space. And you tilt so far over, you think you're going to capsize. Think you're going to drown. Temps has come into her room. That smile of his, same as when he was a boy. Bit awkward, bit sweet. He sits on the bed next to her. He holds her hand and she doesn't pull away. She could say anything to him and he'd forgive her and never judge her. But what do you want to say, Peg, eh, Peg? That you're tired of life and out of your depth? But you won't say a thing. Still swagger on with a belly full of bluster and a blah-de-blah. Who's up for another? I know this was your idea, he says. Cole's the hero. I know it was you. What's going on out there? Cole was rude to Claude, so Claude flew into his face. How is he? Cole or Cress? Cress. Better now you're here. How long are you staying, Peg? Till we take the stabilizers off. Thanks. You look good. She runs her hand over his cheek and chin. Grown into you, haven't you? What? You're looking at me like you want to know something. How'd you get away from him? Let's not tempt. I worry for you. And I worry for you. It's what we do, right? He hit you. Wash your mouth out. This is supposed to be a happy day. I changed the bloody record. Here. And he reaches into his pocket and puts on his glasses self-consciously. I have to wear them now, he says, when I work or read.
They suit you, you reckon? You wear him in bed. He blushes and takes them off, her hand on his leg. Not here, Peg. This is...
I know. I know.
That evening, Peg joined Ulysses in the kitchen and helped prepare dinner for the guests. Cole, Pete and Cress went on ahead to Michaela's, and Peg could hear them in the stairwell. Cole saying something about running over Leslie and Cress saying, "Not Leslie Greenaway." And Cole said, "Ah, Leslie the pug. Ingrid's pug."
"What pug?" said Cress. "Jesus Christ," said Cole, "just when I'd started to feel sorry for you."
Peg was laughing now. "What?" said Ulysses. "Just them," she said, as if they'd all never been apart. Peg took instruction easily. Her first time using a pestle and mortar, first time making pesto too, and she said she found it soothing. Afterwards, she became a waitress for the night, turned a few heads when she interrupted a conversation about Carrara marble. She'd even end up as a comment in the visitor's book, although the page would have to be torn out.
"What's wrong with people?" Cress would say, "writing something like that for all the world to see."
Just before 10, however, Ulysses blew out the candles and turned off the lights. He thought they were heading down to Michaela's, but Peg took his hand and led him back upstairs to his room. "Peg?" She pushed him down on the bed. "Through the window, a black and blue marbled sky, and now you see me, now you don't, moon and stars and household lights and Cole's laugh rising outside Michaela's." "Put these on," she said, reaching into his trouser pocket and pulling out his glasses. She unzipped him, pulled up her dress and straddled him. They didn't move for a while, a slow pelvic rock till it became unbearable. She pressed both hands onto his mouth to stop his groans. At 10:30, they went down to the square. Peg called out to Cress and the old fella's face lit up at the sight of her. Peg sat down next to him and held his hand, and Ulysses grabbed a stool from the neighbouring table and sat next to Pete. He poured out the remainder of the wine and said, "What we interrupt, Cress?"
"Well, I was just about to tell them about my new vision," said Cress. "What's it this time?" said Cole. "England to win the World Cup in 1966, said Cress. "You're dreaming," said Cole. "They're crap. Always have been, always will be."
"But there's more," said Ulysses, lifting his glass.
"This is the genius twist."
Cole turned to Cress.
"Well, Mr. Genius," he said. "Jeffhurst hat-trick." "Mr. Two Left Feet," said Cole. "Mr. Jeff, I've never played for England, Hurst." "He will in February," said Cress. "And he'll be picked for the squad. That's what came to me, and that's the bet. England to win, but with a Jeffhurst hat-trick. Everything on the black."
"I'm in," said Pete.
"You'll have to put the bet on in London for me, Pete, because they don't like that sort of thing here. I'll give you a specially adapted false bottom suitcase to take the money back in." Pete tapped his nose. "Thanks, Cress."
"You ain't going near Tubbs, I hope," said Cole.
"I was thinking Soho Sid."
"Soho Sid," scoffed Cole. "He's still got a patch."
"Quite a big one," said Pete. "Hold up next to the mandrake."
"I like Sid," said Peg.
"I'm after at least 10 to 1, said Cress. 10 to 1, said Cole. "He thinks his blank is Cohen all over again. Lightning don't strike twice, Signor Cresswell."
"But it does, though, don't it?" said Pete.
"Alan Beantree."
"Alan Beantree," said Pete. "You remember him. Out walking his dog, struck by lightning in August 1939. When he recovered, he showed everyone his foot."
"His foot?"
"Where the lightning came out. A year later, out walking his dog, and it happened again."
"Dead?"
"I hope so," said Ulysses, "because they buried him next to me mum and dad."
"But what's all this about?" said Cole.
"About lightning not striking twice," said Pete. "I'm saying it does, because it did."
"But in all fairness, Pete," said Cress, "the two strikes were different."
"Fucking hell," said Cole.
"The first strike that afflicted Alan Beantree was a side flash, when the current jumps from a tall object, in this case a tree, to the victim, Alan Baintree acted as a short circuit for some of the energy in the lightning discharge.
What happened to the dog? Said Peg.
Cinders.
Dead?
No, the dog was called Cinders.
Jesus help me, Temps, said Cole.
It ran off, said Pete. Found a new family in Bow.
And the second strike, said Cress, was a direct strike in the open air. Alan Baintree hadn't even got to the tree. Struck down in his prime he was.
Cress, he was 70, said Peg.
A direct strike it was, the deadliest strike of all, said Cress, from which there's no coming back. Who's for another carafe of red?
I'm in,
they all said. Peg winked at Ulysses. Cress will be all right, was what that wink said. He pushed his leg against hers under the table, their own little energy discharge. Julia noticed it when she brought over the wine. So much static, it nearly lifted her hair combs.
Someone's happy, she said in dialect, before walking off.
As the days passed, Cress's spirit raised its head above the ramparts again, and it was a glorious sight to behold. Ulysses told him to take everyone out so he could get on with the cleaning, and Peg wanted to help Ulysses, but of course it was Peg who Cress wanted by his side. Pete wanted to wander by himself and compose a song or two. I can feel the muse right here, right now, he said.
That's just someone walking on your grave, said Cole.
So with Cole riding Pillion and Peg in the sidecar, Cress pulled out all the stops. And all those experiences he'd had with Paola, no longer dormant, but alive. He gunned it out to Piazzale Donatello and the English cemetery, a green hillock surrounded by choking traffic. But Cress called the place a mirage. Under a September sun, the great cypresses threw down geometrical shadows across the dead, and tight red fists of rose stood out against the white marble monuments. With his hand resting on her tomb, Cress recited Elizabeth Barrett Browning's How Do I Love Thee? Little catch to the back of the throat by the word perfect end. Classic Cressy. He waited for Cole to ridicule him, but Cole didn't. Cole said it was a deeply moving rendition. Cole never used words like that, and even Peg's eyebrows thought it worth a raise. Walking along a shaded pathway, Cole said he was worried about the demolition blighting the terraces. Everyone knew that Cole was his pub, and without the pub, well, it wasn't worth thinking about. And then Cress said,
What'll happen to my cherry tree, Cole?
And Cole said, I'll tie myself to it if needs be, Cress. I can be that kind of man. Now, the following day, Cress had planned a trip to Chianti, but had forgotten to tell anyone about it. He'd hoped Ulysses would drive them out to the vineyards in Betsy, but when morning came, Ulysses had gone. Peg was sunning herself on the terrace. You see anything, Cole? She said. Cole was scanning the square with the telescope.
Nothing, he said. He scarpered.
You seen him?
Said Peg to Pete, who had just come in from his walk.
No, I haven't, Peg. Betsy's gone, though.
Betsy's gone? Said Cress. That'll be it, then. Happens every year, same sort of time. He's gone for the day.
Gone where? Said Cole.
Cress shrugged.
Disappears, sometimes overnight.
Well, I never, said Cole. He's got a woman, about bloody time, and he lit a cigarette.
Peg stayed quiet.
I'm not sure it is a woman, said Cress.
I'd like to think it is, said Pete. Every year, you say, Cress? Cress nodded. I don't think I've heard anything more committed, said Pete. And he even wrote a song about it later that day. 364 Days and Counting, it was called. He wrote it fast and completed it by the time Ulysses walked through the door later that night.
Hey, Temps, listen to this.
Ulysses put his hat on the stand and walked into the living room. A soft melody with a soft chorus about a lifetime lived in a day. Pete ditched the obvious reference to a mayfly. Peg said,
And where'd you go, sunshine?
She said it all nudge, nudge, wink, wink. But Ulysses wasn't in the mood. He went to bed early that night. Contemplative was the word Cressy used to describe him. Peg called Pete into the kitchen and asked him to swap rooms with her, and Pete, all amenable, said, Of course, he's a lovely fella to sleep with. Peg tiptoed into Ulysses' room.
slipped out of her dress and got into bed with him. Ulysses said, I really just want to be quiet, Peg. And with arms around one another, they listened to voices give way to bells, and bells give way to oblivion. Peg said, You got a woman, Temps? And Ulysses said, I don't have a woman. They rolled away from one another to sleep, but the soles of their feet touched all night. Peg, Cole and Pete left the following day. In spite of the protestations, they all took up their allotted positions in the van. Cress had fixed a solid sheet of wood to the back as a replacement door, and Cole had promised Pete they'd stop in Soutigny on the way back. What the fuck's in Soutigny? He said. Claude flew down from the statue and shat on the windscreen, and Pete held up the specially adapted suitcase and tapped it knowingly. No one could bear to watch Ulysses and Peg say goodbye. All set, shouted Cole. Get on with it, said Peg. The ambulance jolted back to life and wailed. Bye, Temps. Bye, Peg.
Good riddance,
shouted the Contessa. And then they were gone. Cress would never forget them turning up for him for as long as he lived. All that love again. Cress thought he'd had more than his fair share, and that, for Cress, was as bad as having none at all. But the tree said, That can't happen. Love's the way. And its leaves quivered as the breeze came in from the southern hills. Tree said, They're starting the grape harvest somewhere.
That's so, said Cress. And the swallows are lining up to leave.
I'll miss them, said Cress.
It's just the way of things.
Sergio Leone rode into the Odeon in 1964. It was the start of the Trilogia del Dolore. Walking out of a fistful of dollars, Massimo said, For me, Ennio Morricone has completely redefined the cinematic soundtrack. And Cress and Ulysses wholeheartedly agreed. Massimo said the same thing a year later, after watching for a few dollars more. Cole sent regular updates on Jeff Hurst and spied on him at the training ground. Cole got a bit of a reputation and not a good one, and Peg told him to lose the binoculars. Cole said Hurst was no match for Jimmy Greaves, and his acid reflux returned. He blamed it all on Cress and his gambling ways. In October, Alice and Pete were arrested outside the US Embassy in Grosvenor Square during protests against the Vietnam War. Alice made the banners that said, Militarism is the same as racism. They were released that night without charge because Cole knew the station sergeant. Cole was waiting for them outside. He said, This is a new low, even for you, Pete. Bless you, said Pete. Jeff Hurst did make the England World Cup squad, but Cole said he'd remain on the bench unless something bad happened to Greavesy. Something bad happened to Greavesy. A leg injury put him out of the quarterfinals.
Why'd you doubt? Said Cress. I feel ill, said Cole. Go to bed then, said Cress. Till when? Till the final.
And Cress hung up. 30th of July 1966 was the final, and the day history was made. Outside Michele's, the sun blazed down on the Campari canopy, now faded to an attractive shade of pink. A crowd had gathered in front of a small black-and-white screen that had been precariously rigged outside. The atmosphere was electric. Literally. One spilt drink away from disaster. It was from this vantage point that Cress, Massimo and Ulysses calmly saw England win the World Cup, and more importantly, Jeff Hurst get his hat-trick. They celebrated quietly and modestly on the terrace that night. A slightly better glass of wine was had.
There's only one Jeff Hurst,
sang an ageing and topless, overweight man in a pub somewhere in East London.
Only one Jeff Hurst, there's only one.
So Osid paid out with grace. It already made a mint, so what did he care? They found out later that he'd been so intrigued by the bet, he'd placed the same one with Tubby Folgate, of all people. So Sid was quids in, and Tubby back to his smarting ways. It took Col an hour to get a telephone connection to Italy that night. How much we win, said Ulysses. A bloody fortune, said Col, unwrapping a mint. The gang had pooled their bet money, and 3 days later, Pete shared out the winnings accordingly, and everyone did very nicely for themselves, thank you very much.
Cole looked after Peg's share on account of Ted. Peg had a ticket out of there finally, but she just needed to know where to go. Alice came back to Florence that summer, the summer she turned 21. She may not have had Peg's looks, but she had something more. She read esoteric works and communed with nature the way Cress had been doing for years. She had taken acid once, but never again. She had seen Bob Dylan play at the Albert Hall and thought he was something else. She had had many lovers, including men, although her preference would always be women, because kissing women undid her soul. Her art school career had been unsuccessful, but it had given her time to inquire and try. She came back from painting and settled on drawing, and technically she was brilliant. She just didn't know what she wanted to say. She walked through the concourse of Santa Maria Novella station with a porter following behind with her luggage. She wore her fringe high and her hair tied back, and denim flares and a white cheesecloth shirt, and she had the requisite beads around her neck and a love bite on her shoulder from the woman she'd shared the sleeper with. A guitar in her left hand and the false bottom suitcase stashed with cash in her right. She saw Ulysses up ahead and her heart surged. "Yuli!" she shouted. He turned. How she'd missed him.